Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If growing up poor affects brain development, how can we help low-income students make up for their challenges? Children raised in financially struggling households tend to receive less nurturing care, hear fewer words, and have fewer enriching experiences in early life than their wealthier peers, and they are often exposed to greater stress as well. Those differences have the potential to negatively affect brain development, putting low-income students at a disadvantage from the get-go. But as my guest has discovered through her research, many low-income students may benefit from a special form of brain training in middle school that can yield an increase of as much as 25% in the ability to understand the gist of what they learn in school or anywhere else. Dr. Jacqueline Gamineau is director of the Center for Brain Health's Adolescent Reasoning Initiative and assistant research professor in the School of Behavioral and Health Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. She joins us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Jacqueline, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How does poverty in early life affect the brain? What does a poor child's brain look like that distinguishes it from a child who has been raised with financial advantages?
Well, much of what we know about brain development is it is your environment is everything. So you think about the studies where orphans are left and they're in isolation and they have very difficult issues growing up with attachment, with learning, etc. While poor children probably don't have that isolation, they do have a poverty of positive interactions often with their parents. Their parents are often struggling to make ends meet. They don't have time to speak with them, to give them the enriching experiences that parents who are not in poverty have. And so what we've found and what other researchers have found is that their brain is developing differently than children who are not raised in poverty. And by different, I mean that they show less ability to use what we call cognitive control, being able to, you know, focus their attention, being able to make good decisions, reason. And also there are structures in the brain that seem to be developing more slowly than in a normal child.
But that doesn't mean that there is no hope. One great thing that we've learned in recent years is that the brain is more plastic than we once thought.
Exactly. The brain is very plastic, and so whatever we can do to intervene, and we have programs such as Head Start in the early years that helps children with some of those academic skills that they may be missing because of their environment. What we used to think was that children were kind of hardwired by the time they were five, and there wasn't a lot of room for plasticity, but we know now that there is. What we found with our research is that if we intervene even as late as middle school, that we can help these children gain academically, which we didn't know before.
If you had to come down on one side or the other, would you say that many children do poorly in school because they're poor, or do many people end up poor because they did poorly in school?
That's a double-edged sword. So probably a little bit of both. It's very hard to, you know, bootstrap your way out of extreme poverty. There are many hurdles these children face. A lot of times, you know, you look at even in the Dallas School District, the schools that have the most problems are those that are in those neighborhoods that have extreme poverty. And so we know that children are capable of learning, and under the right environment, that we can help them. And my study has shown that with cognitive training in seventh and eighth grades, that we can actually see improvements in a very short amount of time, in less than 2 months.
So we talked on this show last week about the critical nature of those first 3 years and how much brain development goes on. You and many of your colleagues now think that early adolescence is a time of almost equivalent brain growth and development.
Yes, that's true. A lot of research has been done with brain imaging, and what they've found, other scientists in addition to us, is that the brain is very plastic during those years. So it's during those adolescent years, which we used to blame completely on hormones. Now we know that it isn't just hormones. It's actually the brain is developing at a very phenomenal rate, and new connections are being made. So training the brain at this time in a child's life is really important because it helps support that development and support those neural connections.
Under ideal circumstances, what is the job of the brain in adolescence? I mean, what's the special job of the brain?
The special job is to develop the frontal lobes fully. The frontal lobes, of course, are what make us most human. It helps us with problem solving, managing our emotions, focusing our attention, being able to reason and problem solve. And so if we do exercises or cognitive training that helps develop those frontal lobes, potentially we are affecting the development of the brain for a lifetime.
So tell us a little bit about this training. The program is called SMART, which stands for Strategic Memory Advanced Reasoning Training. What does that mean in layman's terms?
Well, it's a program that we developed at the Center for Brain Health, and it breaks down for children how to use their cognitive processes so that they can reach the conclusion and understand the meaning of information rather than just simply memorize. So we used cognitive neuroscience theory and what we know from our research about how you and I get to the big picture, and we show children step by step how they can do that as well.
So I don't think I was taught that specifically in school. I feel like I have it today. How does that form in the absence of this kind of training if people are growing up in a, advantageous circumstance?
And in the correct circumstances, it is developing. And we feel that, a lot of our education system, the public education system in particular, is very focused on high-stakes testing. And in the past, this is testing that's required a lot of memorization. And for educators, if my job depends on how well these kids do on these tests, I'm going to be focused on memorizing as well. But in fact, we know from our research that and others that the brain does not do that well when you're just memorizing information. It actually is pre-wired to think more deeply about information, to understand the meaning and always ask why.
So you can, for example, memorize the date that the Revolutionary War started and how long it lasted and who was involved. But if you don't have the skills to figure out why it started or what it meant in the long term, you're losing out on part of your education.
Exactly. You have no meaning to put behind anything, any of the information. You're just regurgitating what you heard. And as we know, we can look up anything in an instant with Google and the internet. And kids feel that way as well. If they don't have to think about information, why go to the trouble of trying to learn it? But once we open up the door and show them how creative and fun learning can be, the world is their oyster.
It also seems like having these skills would make reading much more appealing than if you're just taking in sentence after sentence and not sort of at the same time processing that information. It's not very much fun to read.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's what many kids do, especially kids in poverty. Many of them are struggling readers, but even those who aren't thinking about what they're reading. So it's rather meaningless. And they may do well enough to pass a test or not, but they have no idea of what the information has meant, how they can apply it to their lives. And, of course, that's important whether or not they go to college, because eventually they're going to need to be reasoning, problem-solving adults.
So these are this training is typically given in 10, 45-minute sessions. Is that right?
That's correct.
How do you keep that fun for the students? Because I would imagine that for your average 12 or 13-year-old, if you say that you're going to work on these skills, their eyes glaze over before you've opened your mouth.
Oh, yes. The eye rolling begins immediately. But the way that we do it is we train them using very interactive methods. So we are always involving them. We're asking them why. We're asking them to be creative. We also encourage them by letting them know that there's more than one right answer. Often in school, there's only one answer the teacher's looking for, and who wants to go out on a limb and put themselves out there if they aren't sure they have the right answer? So it actually frees the student's brain up. It frees them up to be more engaged in the learning process.
I feel like there's more than one right answer should be nailed to the door of every classroom in America, because it is something that, I mean, are students surprised to hear you say that?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And teachers sometimes are surprised as well. But when they think about it, there are many ways to solve even a mathematical problem, for example, many ways to go about it. And if a child feels that they are free to do that and free to make those decisions, then they gain confidence immediately.
So this training was originally developed, am I correct about this, to help kids who have ADHD?
Yes, yes. We worked with children who had ADHD initially, also some with a traumatic brain injury, and it was extremely successful with those groups of children. And when we took it into the classroom several years ago, we found that it was also successful with just typically developing children.
Is the effect for children who may have some deficits based on poverty in the home, are they gaining more from this than children who are developing entirely typically?
Well, the statistics show that they are gaining at least as much as the children who are better off financially. And we think in the long run, though, they may be actually getting more out of it, out of the program, because they can benefit from using it. The children who aren't living in poverty are eventually going to pick up these skills just because of the environment, but it may not be until college. I've had kids tell me that they find the program was most helpful when they became freshmen and started freshman English and had to really start to think about information and delve deeper than just the memorization.
So you've been able to track long-term effects of this. Do you
we
know
have.
How long it lasts?
Well, interestingly, we have looked at some of the students that we've worked with a year out, and what we find is that they still retain a lot of the skills that they learned through the cognitive training, or they actually even improve upon. We tracked some of the students that we originally worked with from our 2009 pilot study. They graduated last year. Most of them graduated on time, and they were in DISD schools. And many of them were taking three or more AP classes.
Wow.
So as a group, they were doing really, really well.
You did observe some differences between boys and girls, depending on their ages. Talk about that. Are their brains different culturally, or are they different biologically?
Well, there are some differences biologically, for sure. Perhaps culturally as well. Everyone knows boys and girls develop different on a different trajectory, with girls developing a bit earlier, and brain development studies have shown that as well, that girls do develop certain skills sooner than boys. And our study found that eighth grade girls and boys showed similar improvement, but with seventh graders, it was the girls who showed improvement in the higher order thinking, whereas the boys showed improvement only in fact recall, just being able to remember information.
It's amazing that a year would make so much difference, though.
It is, but if any teacher or parent will tell you, if you look at a child at the beginning of seventh grade to, you know, the end of seventh and even on into eighth grade, there's just changes that are happening. It's almost before your eyes.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Jacqueline Gamineau, director of the Center for Brain Health's Adolescent Reasoning Initiative and assistant research professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. We're talking about help for brains affected by poverty, young brains. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about help for young brains affected by poverty with my guest, Dr. Jacqueline Gamineau, who is director of the Center for Brain Health's Adolescent Reasoning Initiative and also assistant professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at UTD. If you want to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We just had a conversation on the show yesterday about testing and how challenging it can be to really test what matters. How do you, when you're testing for research purposes, the outcomes of this work that you've done with students, how do you know, how do you get the results that really tell you what you need to know?
Well, we use the Scale of Advanced Reasoning, which was developed by the director of the Center for Brain Health, Dr. Sandy Chapman, many years ago. And we've used it fairly consistently in a lot of our different research projects. But it's an interesting test because it helps us determine how a child is thinking. So we ask them to summarize information that they've just recently heard, and what we look for then in their summarizations, are they just regurgitating details, or are they actually showing their understanding of the moral or the ideas that are embedded in just about everything that we read?
Is any of this about just the self-confidence to believe that you as an individual have the right to come up with your own conclusion?
That's probably a very good point, yes. A lot of kids think that they should only do and repeat what adults say rather than think for themselves. And if they can learn that they can think for themselves, that there are different ways to interpret the same information, there's many different right answers, correct answers, then it does boost their self-confidence that they can do it. If they think that all along that they have been thinking incorrectly, just because it doesn't match exactly what the teacher wants, then they do lose confidence and they are not going to speak out. They're not going to be engaged in the learning process.
How much does this kind of training cost per student approximately? I don't know if you have an exact figure or if you can even just sort of speak in general terms.
Well, all of this work has been funded by the state of Texas as well as by other philanthropic organizations here in town. We've had funding from the Meadows Foundation. We've had funding from Communities Foundation, Simmons Foundation. We've been very fortunate that so many generous people here in Dallas are interested in funding education. When we work in the public schools, which is what we've been doing and what we continue to do, it's very cost effective. It costs, we're at this point in time, we're training teachers, and that costs us about $8,000 per teacher. And so if each teacher reaches at least 100 students, I mean, you can do the math, it's fairly cost effective way to reach students.
And are they given sort of a packet of information to use and whatever the materials are, or is this just a matter of them learning the concepts and interpreting them for their classes?
Well, because we're scientists and we want things done with fidelity, we want the program implemented with fidelity. We actually have a fairly stringent training program for our teachers. We train them over 5 days in the summer, and they're with us from 9 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon. And they often complain that their brains are hurting by the end of the day. But we teach them how we have been successful with the program. So we want them to have an understanding of the concepts, but also show them how to engage students and explain why that's so important. We talk to them a lot about brain development and how, even though a lot of people want to blame teenage behavior or young adolescent behavior on hormones or on parenting, it's really because the brain is in asynchrony at this epoch in time. And so, which means their emotional center, their amygdala, is one of the first areas to develop, but it's not yet well connected to the frontal lobes, which is where we reason through those emotions. So them having an understanding of what's going on with their students' brains, I think, helps them as well.
Is there any reason to believe that this kind of training could benefit, say, adults in the workforce who maybe didn't do so well in school, now have jobs and want to succeed in those jobs, but lack some of those like soft skills that employers talk about a lot?
Right. Yes. In fact, we do have Smart for Adults that is held at the Center for Brain Health. We have different projects going on there involving adults, some of them older adults. We have Smart for Soldiers coming back from active duty. We have Smart for just normal adults. We're all aging, so I guess it's normally aging adults. And so we've offered it in many different ways. Of course, on the adult level, it's not quite as explicit. There isn't quite as much hand-holding as there is with children and young adolescents. But it has been found to be quite effective, and we've found differences in brain activation. There's more blood flow to certain areas of the brain, and adults notice a difference in how they think.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Shannon in Arlington. Hey, Shannon.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thank you. Well, my daughter has a working memory deficit. She's 16, but I didn't know better, and I held it back a couple times thinking that she would improve, and I went from private to public. But my basic question is, does the SMART training, does it benefit children that have different types of learning differences? And also, is there any thing that you would recommend, even if we can't, be able to benefit from the SMART training in the classroom, is there anything that we could do at home to enrich the environment or to add to like you said, to change the environment?
Go ahead, Shannon. I'm sorry.
Oh, was there anything that, if you had any suggestions on adding to the environment or things for parents to do to try to, who are in impoverished situations, to try to improve?
All right. Thanks so much for your call.
Well, I think one of the most important things that parents can do is ask children questions, ask them to explain themselves, get them to think about even TV shows they're watching or movies they're watching. Ask them to think about comments that they've heard friends make, if they're, how are they interpreting it? And give them practice in interpreting different situations, whether it's a comic strip or, a movie. There are different meanings, and just encouraging them to do that. Working memory deficits in particular often are related to attention. The less we pay attention, the less that we're going to remember. I mean, you think about it, if someone tells you we don't have to do this much anymore, but if they tell you their phone number, and if you don't write it down right away, if you're just repeating it to yourself, you're probably not going to remember it very long. So it's all about attention and trying to store those memories longer term.
Does this suggest an argument for maintaining the arts in public education? There's such a focus right now on STEM, which I think we all agree is critical, whether people choose STEM careers or not. But it's not all there is to life, and it's not all there is to understanding the world.
Right. And yes, it does. There is a lot of evidence that being creative, using those talents that many children have, are very important. In fact, there is a movement now called STEAM, which is a takeoff on STEM with the arts included. So the A is for the arts. And the idea is that teachers include projects and creative endeavors so that students will be more engaged in the learning process as well.
Do you feel like the testing climate gets in the way of this kind of education to the extent that it happens in some cases sort of holistically in schools?
Yes. Most of the spring semester is every teacher in Texas, certainly, but also around the country, will tell you, is full of the anxiety that comes with doing well on those standardized tests and making sure kids are prepared. And that really takes away from them being able to focus on curriculum because they are focused on making sure that the students are passing the tests.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Sean in Richardson. Hey, Sean.
Hello. And I just was listening to your program and just heard that the SMART program was helping some ADHD students. So I was wondering if it could help autistic student, or do you have any other program like that for helping autistic programs, autistic students.
Thanks for your call.
Well, at the Center for Brain Health, we do have a what we call a social cognition program, and it involves helping students who are on the spectrum of autism to develop better social skills. And you can go to our website, centerforbrainhealth.org, in order to learn more about that research.
Why is emotional regulation such a challenge for students who've been raised in tough environments?
It has to do with what we call executive functions, which are the cognitive functions that are centered mostly in the frontal lobes. Children need to learn very early on how to regulate themselves. I mean, that's if you think about it, even in school, they have to be able to sit. They have to know that they're not supposed to shout in the halls or run down the halls or shout during the school day. Having that regulation is really important to develop early on, and it continues, of course, to develop well into adolescence and beyond. But that's huge, because if you can change your cognition and control your cognition to be able to control those impulses, you can also control better your ability to focus on information. And that helps, of course, just your understanding and being able to take in more information, which is really the job of every student.
Has anything surprised you in the course of developing the SMART programming program and working with students? Was there anything that you and your colleagues were not prepared to see that you have, in fact, observed?
I think the most rewarding thing that we've observed is that children who are normally shy, who seem disengaged from school, once they are free to give answers that may not be the exact answer that we were looking for, but we think about it and we comment on their thinking, just to see their confidence level improve. And it's not just during the SMART program that their confidence improves. It carries over because they feel validated that they can use their brains just as well as other kids in the class.
Have you thought about producing some kind of like parental self-help booklet for people whose kids are not fortunate enough to be on campuses where this is being used?
We have thought about that, and in some of our schools, we are actually offering parenting coursework to help them understand how they can apply many of the principles of SMART at home with their students and help them develop those skills even better.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Scott in Dallas. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just listening and noticed that this sounds remarkably similar to skills that I learned in prep school and logic and rhetoric. I was wondering if your guest could comment on the similarities and differences and whether she thinks it would be beneficial to have logic and rhetoric in public school curriculum.
Thanks, Virgo.
Wow. It would be if they had time, I'm sure. It would be helpful. It really depends on the age and the grade level that students would start something like that. I think, you know, many schools are just overwhelmed by the amount of content that they have to pour into these brains in a short amount of time and hope that most of it is sticking. And so I don't, you know, fitting one more class in would probably be a sticking point for many public schools, but it certainly is a good idea.
Does this training or the work that you've done on brain development in children suggest anything about the ideal, like, student-teacher ratios that we should see in schools? If money were not an object, which, of course, it always will be.
Yes, money's always an object. But, yes, the smaller the groups, 20, 25 students, we think the better the classes are conducted. It's just easier for the teachers. They're less harried, and it's easier for the students to get the individualized attention that each of them needs at some point.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Chiyoko on the line in Dallas. Hi, Chiyoko.
Hey, how are you?
Very well,
Hi.
Thanks.
Okay, I have a real quick question here. I have ADHD all my life. I'm 60 years old, and I see some things that are deteriorating, and I see some things getting better. I'm working on my my master's degree at this time, and I was wondering, could the or does the center have capabilities of helping someone at this age? And is there a, you know, since I see things declining, I don't know if it's because I'm growing older or what. Is there any kind of facilities that can enhance some of these skills that are declining? And will this program be able to facilitate or help me with, you know, okay.
Well, before we let you go, Chiyoko, what do you feel like is declining and what do you feel like is getting better for you?
My memory, however, my concentration is getting a little bit better. I used to take Adderall. I don't take that no more because I have, learned behavior to, I just don't do some of those things that are impulsive.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for your call.
Well, that's a good question, and congratulations on finishing up another degree. Of course, the center does offer adult SMART courses, and the best thing to do is go to our website, centerforbrainhealth.org, all one word, and to learn more about the different research projects that's happening there at the center. We also have a new program that's going to be opened up in another building, hopefully in the next couple of years. It's called the Brain Performance Institute. And so you may want to look into that. They're also going to be offering SMART to adults at a greater level than they're doing right now. But there are a lot of things going on at the center right now that may be able to benefit you.
And, of course, all that can be discovered online, what's going on in upcoming projects, that sort of thing. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Jacqueline Gamineau, who is director of the Center for Brain Health's Adolescent Reasoning Initiative, also assistant research professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. We're talking about help for young brains affected by poverty. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about help for young brains affected by poverty with Dr. Jacqueline Gamineau, director of the Center for Brain Health's Adolescent Reasoning Initiative. They recently completed a study that found that a certain kind of training can help young people who have been affected by poverty to regain skills or to gain skills in the ability to get the big picture when studying information. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Jacqueline, one of the things I love most about talking to scientists is that your eyes are always on the horizon, right? You've just sort of completed one project and you have the results in, and there's something else you want to learn. What is that for you right now?
Right. We finished the project where we were doing the training in the schools. We wanted to expand, and we had funding from the AT&T Foundation to expand the program into training teachers. And so we started doing that, I guess it was about 4 years ago. And so with our AT&T funding, we were able to take the program outside of Texas. So we are actually in Massachusetts. We're in Arizona, Florida. We have one school in Kentucky as well. But we are also funded by the state of Texas to work with middle school teachers here. And this allows us to offer the SMART program, the training first to the teachers, the 5-day training I spoke of earlier, and then also to support the teachers in the classroom to be able to provide the SMART program for every student that they reach, to provide pre and post testing as well. And then we're also collecting data on standardized test scores. So here in Texas, it's the STAR test. And in Massachusetts, of course, it's the MCAS. And we are we're able to look at students who have had the program versus those who have not. And we're finding that, by and large, students are doing better on their standardized test scores. Even though this is not test prep, it is teaching them to think. So if you learn to think at a deeper level, it plays a big role in just being able to remember information to understand.
How did you settle on the 10 45-minute sessions? Did you experiment with a variety of combinations of how to actually get this training into people's heads?
We did. And initially, when we were working with students with ADHD, we worked with the children at the Center for Brain Health, and we were able to determine how much of the program we needed to infuse with them in order to get those results. And because most school classroom periods are 45 to 50 minutes, it fits very nicely. We don't do the 10 sessions back to back. The brain needs time to consolidate information. So we actually ask the teachers to do every other day to do a SMART training. And then in between, the students go back to their regular curriculum. And then the next week, they would go back again and do a few more sessions. So the sessions are done fairly rapidly in a four-week period. So we do this because the brain is plastic, and we know that the plasticity is extremely important when interventions are provided in the short term rather than stretched out over the long term, because we see those brain changes immediately.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Perfetto in Fort Worth. Hi, Perfetto.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes. I have a 7-year-old son. He's in second grade. He's a delightful little boy. He's a good athlete. He's a good friend to all of his peers. But he has a moderate to severe speech and language disorder. And also he's been tested at a IQ in the mid-70s. And so he's been labeled as a slow learner. And it just seems like there's some kind of a disconnect between hearing information and understanding what it means, and also retaining knowledge. It seems like his only way to really learn anything is to repeat it over and over and over again. But besides that, he's absolutely normal and delightful. And I'm very encouraged by hearing that the brain continues to develop even into the adolescent years, because I thought, like you said, that it was just hardwired by the age of 3 and that there was really no more hope of development. So I'm just calling to see two things. One is if the SMART program is available to anyone outside of Dallas, because we're in Fort Worth. And also if there's any skills that I as a parent can apply or help that would help him with his comprehension and also retaining knowledge.
Thanks so much for your call.
Those are great questions. Because we're funded by the state of Texas, our program is open to any teacher, any public school within the state at no charge to the school or the school district. It is, however, focused on the middle school years, mainly because some of these reasoning and higher order thinking skills are not yet ready to be developed in the brain at age 7, for example. However, there are things that any parent can do to help encourage that deeper thinking with their students. And even a child who may have some language difficulty is asking them questions, reading to them, making sure that they understand what you're reading, asking them questions midway through a book. With your son in particular, I would think it would be important maybe after a couple of sentences to ask him what he thinks is going to happen next, or have that dialogue with your child so that you understand that they're thinking about the information. They're not just hearing words, random words.
I would imagine that practice also gets children in the habit of thinking, well, this is what we do when we read a story, even if we're not talking to anybody else, if there's no one else in the room. As a reader, we stop and ask ourselves, I wonder what's going to happen next.
Exactly. And it's making children aware of the fact that we all talk to ourselves in our heads, and that's a very important part of cognition, and we're always thinking about why something is happening, what's going on, and we're always interpreting. It's just that we do it so naturally, we probably don't think about it. And sometimes it just takes holding a child's hand and helping them understand that that's a natural way to go about reading, to go about having a dialogue with friends, is that there are inferences buried in almost everything that we say, we do, we see. And they just need to be aware that they can interpret that and think about the meaning of what's going on around them.
What do you hear from teachers who have had this training, have actually put it into place? Do they come back and ask for additional help? Are they excited about certain aspects of the program?
They're very excited about the program. They're excited about what they see in the classroom. They're excited that their students are engaged. If you head into a middle school anywhere, be it public or private, of course, you're going to see an awful lot of disengagement by students. It's part of that brain development that they're undergoing right now. But when you get a child engaged in the learning process and excited about being creative with their answers and understanding, that's exciting for teachers. And it reminds them of why they went into teaching, to see that spark and to feed off the spark that they see in student learning.
We have an email here from Mary in Dallas who asks if you would discuss the effects of early attachment on the developing brain, especially in the area of emotional regulation. Are attachment issues addressed in the adolescence to increase the development of executive functioning?
That's a great question, and one that we probably don't know exactly the answer to. But yes, attachment is very important for children. But because the brain is plastic, I mean, we can help them form those attachment abilities even later on, although the best time, of course, is in those first 3 years. So yes, anything that you can do to provide an environment that's enriched, that children are able to hear adults have conversations or talk about important things, not just fight or give directives, is very important for the developing brain. It's something anyone can do.
And to be sure we all understand, attachment is the ability to form healthy relationships with people who are sort of reliable and trustworthy and will take care of you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Twyla on the line in the Mid-Cities. Hey, Twyla.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
I have a question. As a licensed professional counselor in the state of Texas, I am a child and adolescent therapist. That's my focus. And I use cognitive training type skills in my practice. Is the SMART program available, or will it be available for those of us who deal with children and adolescents that do have all types of learning disorders, as well as anxiety, depression, and things like that around their learning?
It's not available currently, but we hope to make it available in the future. It's really just being able to assure that people are maintaining the intent of the program and not just slicing and dicing and taking the pieces that they like and then not having the same effects. So our goal is to really benefit children as much as possible, but not to shortchange them by providing a program that doesn't give them everything they need.
I would imagine there's an internal tension for you and your colleagues who are involved in this between just getting the research done and developing these programs, and then also facilitating their rollout to the general public.
Right. And that's so we're very different from the average professional development that most teachers participate in all the time. Often they go through these very exciting professional developments. They're handed a booklet and wished best of luck with getting these same kinds of results. So what we do is we do the 5-day training in the summer with our teachers. And then once the students are back in school, we administer a pre-assessment to see how well the students are reasoning before they start SMART. And then we go into the classroom and we help co-teach with the teacher for several sessions of SMART so that we are sure that the teacher understanding is there and the students are understanding as well. So it's been a very hands-on program for my team as well to go out and make sure that the SMART program is going well for these students so they're getting the full benefit.
I would imagine that for the students who have this training, obviously there's a bit of variation from one individual to the next in terms of the benefits, but are there some who really don't seem to derive any benefit, and are there some who are just fantastically affected by this, and have you learned anything about the differences between those individuals?
Yes, of course, with all humans, we're all different and we're all going to take to some things and not to others. We do know that the program, because we've based the program on cognitive neuroscience, it really is a natural way for our brains to learn. And so if as long as we can get a student engaged enough and understanding that they can do this too, we usually see gains in just about everyone. There are some students, of course, who are very obstinate and don't want to be engaged in the program, and you know that's just part of life. But we try to reach as many as possible, and we try to, even though it's not cool in middle school to be smart, we try to let them know that they all have that potential to be smart and to understand information.
Do you feel like that's changing? Like there's not so much pressure to act like you're not smart in middle school, or is it as bad now as it's ever been?
I think it's the same.
I'm curious, as a scientist, what your sense is of the value of instinct in parenting and sort of just doing what seems to feel right, as compared with the value of doing as much reading as you can, maybe, you know, educating yourself about every possible option and following sort of the advice given to parents?
Well, that's a good question as well. Instincts are great, I think. But I think if the better educated you are as a parent, the more you have an understanding of what your child needs to have optimal development, the better. Of course, there are many parents out there who are cramming so many activities into their children's lives that they don't have time for those interactions. But we were born to converse with each other, to think about the world, to reason and to problem solve and to work together as, you know, family units. And so I think the more that parents can encourage that and leave time for that, whether it's, this is a cliche, but the nightly family dinners, or, you know, even when you're in the car for carpool, talking to them, asking them questions, not just telling them things. I think a lot of us tend to want to just tell children things and not ask them about their opinion. And so I think that's important.
Have you had a lot of interest from schools of education, universities that are teaching the next generation of teachers?
Some, yes. And we haven't branched into that area quite yet. We do work with some Teach for America new teachers. And the problem is that young teachers are often overwhelmed just with the whole process of teaching, and it's more of our veteran teachers who see the difference in the students. They know what they are more capable of, or they think they know, and they're often surprised when their students take so well to the SMART program.
Dr. Jacqueline Gamineau is director of the Center for Brain Health's Adolescent Reasoning Initiative and assistant research professor in the School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences at the University of Texas at Dallas. She joined us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Jacqueline, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.